सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सदि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay. Okay. Consider society as well. Rules which can increase the happiness of the human being in society are advisable. That is called morality. Right? So in other words, the idea of morality is what rules increase happiness, not what rules are actually in line with the universal laws. Does that make sense? So, much of the time, for people who are practical, if you're dealing with more of a long-term culture, then most of the time, the rules will be pretty much in line with universal laws, though it won't be, it'll still be atheistic, right? But if you're dealing with more short-term, then they'll just, whatever increases the happiness in human society, that kind of morality is—it's not necessarily that it's moral. You know, like what do you call it? Honor amongst thieves. Mm-hmm. You know, like that. It's still they're stealing. You're getting a reaction, but amongst the thieves, you're not stealing from each other. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So, yeah. Does that make sense? So otherwise, it's okay. Well, there's social rules. So isn't that the same as dharma? No, but the social rules are for increasing happiness. Right? Like that. That's the thing. So the first stage, your atheistic immoralist, it's like he'll follow rules if it's good for him. But if it's not good for him, he'll break the rules, the social rules. Well, atheistic moralist, right, then he will follow the social rules because it's good for everybody, right? And because the idea is if it's good for everybody, it'll be good for me also.
Anarchist
people
in the first category?
They're a bit of a hodgepodge, those guys, because it just depends upon what is the purpose of their anarchistic philosophy, because that may be philosophical, it may be political, it may be, generally it's not economic so much. It might be, though, sometimes it's economic, sometimes it's sensual. It would just very much depend upon what they're, because they're just using anarchy as a tool to get what they want. Does that make sense? Yeah. Because here it's talking about the overall mentality. It's not talking about what techniques. Here it's not saying whether using, you know, monarchy or democracy or oligarchy or any of these kind of things, or what economic system you're using or what kind of sensual engagements you're using. It's just talking about cultivate the fine things of life, create rules, create the sophistication, and that's what improves human life. Right? You just make it sophisticated, then the immoral atheist will relate. But if you that sophistication includes the social rules that you will follow, then that brings it to the next level. Okay. Gaining happiness through morality makes man superior to animals. That's the difference. The other one is the excellence of man is his sophistication. That's what makes him different from the animals. While here it's morality makes him different from the animals. that is necessary for man to accept individual suffering in order to give happiness to society. Now this is where the point is, where it's, you know, where you're just talking about the just the natural, just aspects of that, you know, or where it's going above and beyond, you know, it's kind of like it becomes more of a philosophy or something like that, or more of a one's own personal kind of commitment or practice. Because that, then you can take, this is where it goes to extreme. Just like the, we were discussing yesterday, that the selfishness, you know, as long as it's in a, basically you don't rock the boat, then you can be basically as selfish as you like, as long as you're cooperating with others to get what you want. But as soon as you, because the point is your own selfishness, as soon as that becomes so prominent that it doesn't allow others to get what they want, then the system starts to fall apart. That's where it'll be seen as weak. Right? It's not that it's not that it's strong in the other way, as far as, you know, higher sentiments and everything, that your society is anything more than sophisticated animals. But at least it'll be cooperative. Right? Then in this, where it says, necessary for man to accept individual suffering will give happiness to society, they take that to extreme. Then this is where this one starts to be a problem, because then it's a matter of, it's all about the state, it's all about this and that, and then, you know, the individuality gets lost. Because the point is that state's made up of individuals, so if you lose individuality, actually you've lost the state. Because if the state's just about controlling, you know, just for power and money, after a while that becomes, you know, I mean, it's very base, it just drops back down to that the state becomes the important self-centered individual, right? And then there's no cooperation. So it's a delicate balance, because in all these systems, because God's being left out, God is the natural balance to the system. It means you're engaging your senses, but it's still according to the laws that God gives. You're engaging in social interactions according to the laws that God gives. Your economics, your justice according to that. You know, your actual overall social system based on dharma of the living entities, that then is connected with the Lord. Or your understanding of the transcendence is connected to the Lord. So all that is within the culture of bhakti. So the fifth level includes the culture that all these four lower ones find their actual balance. The proper engagement of the senses, the proper engagement of one's wealth, and the proper social interaction, the proper balance of spiritual understanding. So the fifth includes the other four. The other four don't necessarily include. But dharma, if you take the third level, is your strongest. Yes. Because it can give you benefits both ways. Yes. Like that. Yes.
Can we say that in this five different levels, it's like five different levels of identification for the living entity?
Yeah. No, it means people identify with the pranamoy, okay. Like that.
But can you say like... the full identification with the body, then the mind, then...
It's senses, extended senses, then the mind, then the intelligence, then the actual devotional, if you're using that. Because the first two are simply the senses.
Yes.
It's just whether you're selfish or selfless.
Yes.
That's all. But it's still about senses.
And when it is about dharma, it is about when it is dharma at the level of dharma, I mean it's
then it's the mind.
Mind.
Or knowledge, jnanamoy. It's not realized because you're not including the soul there. But it's actually the knowledge of how the nature of something functions. Right? Somebody's nature, what it is. Brahman has a nature, Kshatriya nature,
yes.
Grihastha nature, Brahmacharya nature. So and the nature of the different situations and the nature of everything, how to use the intelligence to put all those together so that you know how to behave properly.
Yes.
Right? Because it's a matter of the whole social system working together in uniformity with the laws of God. Right? Now your artha and kama are in their natural state working on those same principles, but they're not looking in necessarily at the overall. They're only focusing, okay, how to use those rules to get artha.
Yes.
Or how to use those rules to get kama.
Yes.
So then, it's like the Vedic philosophies that only deal with those portions of the Vedas that support their...
So they're
not whole.
Yes.
So our Artha and Kama are not whole unless they're in connection with Dharma. Mm-hmm. So someone like Chanakya, he gives Artha and Kama, Artha, Niti, Kama, all in connection with Dharma. So that's why his system is recommended. So in other words, Chanakya is taken as the central teacher of these aspects. You know, Manu's the Dharma, and then what Chanakya gives for these other areas, that you would take as your essential. And then you can give support of other aspects.
The Bhishma Sutras? Bhishma?
But, yes, but the thing is you're going to... In your practical application, you're going to use Chanakya. You can give support from that, because he's taking from all these books. That's the point, is he's already compiling them all. But, you know, if you want a little bit more detail of this or that, yes, then that's fine. Because it's Bhishma gives, Narad gives, you know, the Yaksha gives. There's so many nitis like that. You know, Niti in story forms, Yitupadesh Panchatantra. Same things, but it's just given in story form. That is called selfless morality. Okay, so rules which can increase the happiness of a human being, society, is called morality. And then, what is... when you take that in consideration of the individual accepting austerity for the greater society, that's called selfless morality. Right? But in any case, in other words, so there's even two levels within that. You have, it's a matter of how selfless they go or how much it's just cooperation.
Yes.
So the minimum it's cooperation, so no one does anything to disturb the system. Then ideally it becomes more selfless, to the point where you don't want anything from it, you this and that. So you're working on Naishkarmya, but there's no knowledge of soul, no knowledge of God. So it gets dry. So you won't find many people functioning on that. So they're not popular philosophies. And is the only path for man, right? So you must cultivate all the positive sentiments such as love, friendship, and compassion in order to increase the overall happiness of society. Right, so this is where you have a little bit of the bohemian aspect thrown in. But bohemians, then they had that little bit of that, how do you call it? Anarchist element. Because it's so much, you know, so the arts and all these things, but it's just a particular, it focuses in this area. So within this group, you're going to have a lot. I would say your major groups of philosophies, religions, everything, all fit in this group. Like that. Even if they profess that their God is involved, it's not really, they don't understand the nature of the human and all that. So it's like somehow or another adding the theistic element, you know, to this.
Yes.
It doesn't really kind of, it's still Upadharma. By doing this, violence, hatred, and other evil tendencies will not be able to contaminate the heart. Right? You're cultivating love, friendship, compassion. But what's the basis of love? Basis of compassion, basis of friendship. So you're overly attached, you're overly, you know, overly sentimental, things go wrong. So it's only when this is brought and dovetailed in line with God consciousness that it actually balances. Does that make sense? The other one, he's just engaging in the senses, but unless the senses are connected to the Lord, it's always going to end up being miserable. Same with this group. Right? So you're selfish, you know, selfish, self-centered, or the selfless, you know, more, they're both going to have problems until it's connected to the Lord. Universal love is universal happiness. But the only problem is how do you create universal love? Sounds great, but you can only do it if you're in line with the universe, and God made the universe so that, you know, or even there, is that, how do you define universal love? How do you know it is universal? Unless you've observed and saw, did a study throughout history, what elements of action or interaction or expression then we're always favorable and people always appreciate it. All right, and then make that the rules, but they don't do that either.
How can we say that it is a type of idealism?
It's a kind of idealism, yes, because this is still within karma. Because here we get his positive, positivists. Yeah. So the universal love is, you have the positive, it's all forms of karma. Right? The thing is I think the first three are all karma, basically. Yeah. Then when you get to the fourth, that's where you start to get the negativists.
Oh,
you
yes,
know, because
yes.
The positivism didn't work, so yes. Then they turn to the negative, the pessimism. Like that. So you get those groups there, just destroy this, that. But the problem is they don't really know the soul. As you have these five levels according to the Vedic, so they'll actually be better situated. Like a gross materialist in India, the enjoyment and facility he has for the senses is way greater than, at least in the previous, in the culture, than what they had in Europe.
Yes.
Right? In Europe, they're fighting over spices and, you know, scented oils and all those kind of things. That's standard stuff over here. When I came, I remember coming in the 70s, you go into these, you know, these businessmen's places, you know, really wealthy people's place. They would always have a little bit of cotton, and on it they have some oil, some attar, you know, kus. So like the summer it would be kus, and the winter it would be henna, like this. And it's put inside the ear. There's this place in the ear you can stick it. And you just put one drop on it, and you keep it there. And in those days, the attar, if you put a drop of attar for 1 month, it would give smell. Now they call it attar. You can put it on, and by the evening you can't smell it anymore. But that was 1 month it would last. And, you know, the fragrance around the head, so in the winter you put kus, it would keep your head cool. Right? You know, the spices, the foods, the culinary science, everything like this, then they're such much better enjoyers. You know, so the West, they try to do all this, but they don't, you know, they do their best, you have to give them, you know. What do you call it? Would you say an A for effort or an E for effort, or you give them something, some credit for effort, you know? But it's not that they're really great enjoyers, you know. Okay, take up ways of increasing this happiness. Right? So they've just taken this selfish sense gratification and extended it, taken it to a farther level, so they've improved on it. But, you know, so positivists such as Kant and Mill, and socialists such as Herbert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Herbert Spencer, as well as lay Buddhists and atheists, firmly believe this philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Lay Buddhists, because the other stuff will, they're generally into this. The others will be into more the fourth stage. So atheists, they're also this, because if they're sophisticated, then they're... Because on the first level, they're atheists, but they don't think about it much. It's not that they'll philosophize much, because they're just worried about themselves. The second group, they'll sit there and argue with you all day. Right? Moralists worshipping a fictitious god accept the same philosophy. Right? Because otherwise you say, no, but they're theists, some of them. No, but it's a fictitious god. They make up. Accept the same philosophy, but add, belief in God is also a principal moral duty. They say you should, but they make up their own God. Okay. Morality can never be perfect until man has faith in God. Belief in God clearly contributes to moral standards in the following ways. Right? So in here, what he's saying is this, the fictitious God element, is this, is they're the ones saying belief in God is also a principal moral duty?
Well, now we're on the theistic moralist, but there's two kinds of theistic moralists. There's a pseudo-theist and an actual theist.
Theist, okay.
So this is the pseudo-theist.
This is the pseudo-theist. Okay. So, I see. So he was just saying that Kant and Mill and Herbert Spencer, like that, they come into this group.
No, they're the previous group. They're atheistic,
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Theistic moralists.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying that was just having said it, they just concluded by saying that.
Yes, Mark.
Okay. So it's good as to put in like a heading, so you know, then it makes it very clear. Okay, so belief in God. So belief in God is, this is for both. Then he's going to explain if it's a real understanding of God or not. But these 10 points apply to both groups. Okay. One, even with a strong sense of morality, sometimes the attraction of sense objects is so strong that even great moralists are defeated. If the opportunity arises to enjoy immorality in secret, belief in God will act as a preventative measure. God can see what man cannot. If man thinks like that, then he will not be able to perform acts contrary to morality in secret. Right? Because remember when we were discussing the more extended version, then the point is even these moralists, their point is that the social rules are for interacting with the society. But if you're in the privacy of your own home and you can get away with immoral acts, since the whole philosophy is based on sense gratification, and it won't affect others and no one else will know, then what's the problem? It means if it'll affect others, you know, or others will know, then you shouldn't do it. But if you could do things in your house and no one would know, how is it going to affect the society? So therefore society will not be damaged by your, you know, this immoral behavior like that. So that's also part of their element. So with this, then, if you add in theism, then God can see even in the, you know, privacy of your own home or wherever, you know, the secret element is, like that. Two, by having belief in God, man can die peacefully due to happiness born of his faith. Right? Because otherwise, if it's just the senses, then you're going to have a problem that... The senses kind of give out on you at times. Right? You know, so you can't die peacefully. There's so many things you want, so many things you want to do, but you can't. Does that make sense? So, this way, then, belief in God, then you could die peacefully, because then, okay, you're leaving this and going on to some other place. But with the others, they're atheistic. When you die, that's it. You know, the chemicals just go back to where they were from in the first place. You know, it was a good run of chemicals, like that. Everyone will accept that faith in God produces greater tendency to perform pious acts than morality alone. Right? It's just natural, because then there's someone bigger, because just being moral, who sees it? Who's going to appreciate it? But if it's morality based on God, then God sees it. Even if no one else sees it, you'll tend to be more moral and more pious when people can't see. Four, the life of a moralist with faith in God is more peaceful than that of a person with morals alone, because the morals is all for sense gratification, so there's always going to be anxiety. While the aspect, when you're talking faith in God, you add this element of satisfaction. Right? Satisfaction isn't part of the first two levels of philosophy. Right? Because it's all about increasing, improving, making it better. Like that. No, they do philanthropic activities. It means in they do philanthropic activities in the second level. Because that's all part of morality, being good, being nice, sharing, you know, the element of sacrifice. It's all there. So in other words, all the different forms that look good are all there. But it's just the element of trying to please a superior person. That's left out. So all those religious elements are left out. It's its own religion, of course. All these levels are basically their own religion. But it's just whether it's connected with the proper aspects of religion.
Yeah. Today they call it secular humanism.
Secular humanism.
Oh, okay. Animal. Well, they claim that there are these universal secular values, that the value, we don't need to believe in any religion in order to have common values like these.
It means that's the second level, or you're talking?
Second
level. It means there are, but the point is why are they, unless that's coming from why would they be consistent unless they're coming from a consistent source? That's the whole thing. You know, just like Nyaya is mentioning that around nature works perfectly in harmony with itself, and we're not in control of that. Excuse me. So it's not that any one of us is doing that. It's not, you know, you don't also don't have the problem with the, you know, one person's dreaming it up.
Yeah.
I mean, in actuality, that Mayavad concept that one or the Buddhist that one person's dreaming all this and then everybody else, it's actually true. It's just it happens to be Lord Vishnu. It's his dream, right? You know. But of course, if you're God, then okay, then you try to, you know, work it out. But. But you still that, but so that means there must be a higher intelligence that's making that work. So that therefore there must be a superior person. Right? Otherwise, how does all these elements come? Because of your cause and effect, you can't have all this personal unless there is a person. You know, there is natural logic, of course, but just by logic means we understand it like that because therefore surrender to the Guru, therefore it makes sense because we have the grace of the Lord. You can understand these things. In other words, the logic can be used. But for someone who doesn't have any faith, then just by logic they may not understand. It's only because the devotee is explaining it. Therefore, it's connected with the chit potency. And if they have in any way some respect or some interest, then they get the effect of the Lord's mercy. Then they can understand it. But it's not because you're giving a logical argument that will convince them. It's because the chit potency is there. You could use something else. You know, just tell a nice story, and that could have the same effect. Like I was actually surprised. I was in one of the universities really giving a talk. Then, as an example, I said something about my grandmother. And after the lecture, one of the students came up and they very much appreciated that it had that personal touch to it. I'm just thinking, what's that got to do with reality? But yeah, but they liked it. Okay. Okay. If God actually does exist, then by faith in him so much is gained. If he does not exist, then there's still no harm in believing. Right? On the other hand, if God does exist, it is detrimental not to have faith in him. Therefore, a true moralist must have faith in God. You know? So it's I said, you know, it's like the how you say that typical Hindu kind of aspect to keep everybody there just in case, you know.
On the altar.
Yeah, you know, you have everybody there just in case. You know, better he's there than we missed out, right? So, but here, yeah. So, better you have belief in God, even if he's not there, because we see that it improves the moral standard anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if he is there, then you're going to get all that benefit.
Yeah.
But now if he is there and you don't have faith, then you're going to get it to be detrimental.
So there's one French mathematician named Pascal. He came up with Pascal's wager. He said if there's a 50-50 chance that you're better off believing in God, because the benefit or the payoff of that would be greater than, you know, not believing.
Yeah, because it means if he's not there, you don't get anything anyway.
Yeah.
So by not believing or believing in non-belief, then it's not that you get any benefit from it.
Yes.
But if you believe in belief, then if the, you know, then yeah. What do you call it, Pascal's?
Pascal's wager.
Pascal's wager.
Yes. That's mathematical proof.
Yeah. So it's just the odds.
Reasons.
So in other words, then you could always consider it. You know, house always wins. Then. You know, you have the universal house, so it's going to win. So better bet on the house.
Sure. Imagine France, this person, Pascal, is quite more well-known.
He's well-known.
Yeah, not like Auguste Comte, it's not so much well-known.
Okay.
But Pascal, everybody studies books.
Yeah. Okay, so everybody knows.
Yes. Okay.
Who's the other one? Who's the guy that has problem in getting out of bed in the morning?
David Hume.
Hume. Okay, where was he from?
He was in Scotland.
Yeah. Scotland, okay. Maybe it was just the floor was cold, you know? Winter mornings, get out of bed, you know, barefoot on the floor, you know, so then all these things come up like that. Just, you know, other ways to keep him in bed, you know? Or like breakfast in bed, so that would just give that opportunity, you know? Six, there is happiness in worshiping the Lord, and that happiness is purer than any other happiness. There is always some disturbance in material happiness, but the happiness derived from worship of the Lord is devoid of disturbance. Right? Since the idea of the material, the moralistic endeavor is to generate happiness, just like the immoral endeavor is to generate happiness. So now if by worship of God it generates more happiness than the morality or immorality, then one should consider that. Seven, by belief in God, the tendency towards righteousness in the mind grows very quickly. So one is that the negative is that you will you'll try to avoid the negativity, you know, as it was given in the first point, right? And then you have the element of it's just a natural next step of morality. And then this point now is taking into the positive aspect, is that then righteousness grows very nicely. Just by that contact with the Lord, then it grows. Eight, by faith in God, compassion and tolerance become stronger, because that was very important for your universal love, like that. Compassion and tolerance. By belief in God, there's more eagerness to perform selfless action. Right, so since they're basing their morality on selfless work, then by worshiping God, that becomes natural. Because the other one, then you're doing it for who? Just the society? Just for the rules? You know, it's not really dynamic. But in this way, then. And by 10, by belief in God, acceptance of afterlife arises. When this arises, man cannot be disappointed by any event in life. So no matter what happens here, if there's an afterlife, then things can get better over there. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you have belief in God, then, you know, there's more of a chance that the afterlife will be better.
Perhaps the hippies are somewhere here and be classified.
Depends which hippies, because there's different kinds of hippies. You have East Coast, you have the West Coast. I would say it's probably, no, because it's more impersonal. It's kind of like if you took this with the impersonal. But that's your West Coast dirty hippies. It started, though, the free love was more the East Coast, but somehow or another it stayed in that more idyllic element on the West Coast. I think East Coast became much more intellectual and went much more quickly into drugs, I mean hard drugs and everything like that. West Coast eventually, because everything's slower on the West Coast. Whatever happens on the East Coast, it takes 2 years for it to hit the West Coast. Like that. Is it still like that or is it quicker now with the internet? Still about that.
More like that.
Yeah, like that. And then in some pockets, you know, like I think even still in Oregon, you still have 60s hippies like that. So, but their idea of universal love was more sentimental than philosophical. You know, I mean, I guess their group leaders may be more philosophical.
Mm. Yeah, but they weren't really known for their worship or their feeding the poor.
Yeah, no, it'd be just an interesting thing of just doing things for your own senses, but at the same time sharing with others. At the same time, it's an interesting blend. The first, second, and fourth levels.
It definitely sounds like it's some of the tribal elements.
Yeah. Pleasant tribals, yeah. Pleasant cooperative tribals. Okay. That might work, yeah. So here. Oh, brother, even if God does not exist for the above reasons and many others as well, it is necessary to believe in some form of God. seeing all the direct results of worship of God, the atheist is defeated by the pseudo-theist. Right? Because here's the point. Is even if he doesn't, that it's still better. Like that. So therefore, that's why he's pseudo-theist. Like that. Okay, he's defeated by the pseudo-theist. And like Kant, same. It's just here there's a P put in. Because in the previous page there was no P.
The same one.
Same guy. So how did he spell it? Huh? With or without a P?
I'm not sure. I think it was without the P.
Without. So who put the P in?
I think it was the...
Huh?
I thought it was with the P.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's more of an English thing.
It's more like on the internet, or generally in academia, it's generally without the P.
Without the P.
Yeah, but there's various spellings because the way you transliterate or you change it.
Oh, what form you use to translate.
Yeah, but even then, it's the same. I'm not sure.
But it's French, though.
Yeah, so it should.
But French still uses the Roman letters.
So I'm not sure.
It's not like Devanagari or something. Yeah, it's the same, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But they would spell it without the P.
Yes, always.
Okay. Okay. And like Kant, they accept some worshipable object. Was he the one who was saying about you make an imaginary form of
universal brotherhood or something like that?
Who's the one that was that? A combination of the daughter, the mother, the wife, you know, and that kind of thing, and by
that was cool.
Except some worshipable object. Okay. Though there are differences between Jaimini's Karmakanda, Patanjali's meditation on God, and Kant's fictitious worship, the result is the same. Kant has expressed himself clearly on these points. See how it's one piece of that. The lack of the P is now one out. Now, hearing about the doubts here, now it's changed. Kant has expressed himself clearly on these points, whereas Jaimini and other proponents of karma are more cautious and do not reveal their minds. Right? In other words, they talk about the supreme but don't reveal that it's not real. But while Kant is very, you know, clearly just says, like this thing, even if it doesn't exist, but it's better to have one. So if you're going to have one, have something to meditate on. And so, you know, this is, you know, I guess being French, then naturally then it should be a woman, right? You know, why something else, you know? You know, not a dump truck or, you know, something else. Yeah, I mean, who came up with the, you know, big slab of, you know, black rock that kind of floats around in the universe?
Jaimini's imaginary, is that saying karma is supreme, that's imaginary, or is this referring
to... It's just a matter of there's the element of the supreme is there, but they don't really get into the personal aspect, how it actually mechanically works, other than what mechanics is, I do good work, then they give good results. But at the same time, it's not even important that God is giving the results, because God's potency is coming through the material energy, so the material energy takes care of it, so that's all that we need to worry about. You know, it's just like we don't worry about the whole postal system, we just know the postman shows up. So we interact there. So of course, you know, you can talk about there is, but it's not very important. So then these are all the pseudo-theists then.
Yes.
Yeah. So it appears they've come to this third level, but all it is they've added in the idea of a supreme that to improve the quality of morality. Not, is that what you were saying before? It's not that there's the supreme, therefore be moralistic. No, moralism is there, and it's improved by adding a supreme.
So the moralism is the important.
Yeah, the moralism is the center. That's why we hear sometimes we talk very strongly on the moralism, where the moralism becomes more central than the supreme or devotional service. In other words, when morality takes the superior position over the fifth, you know, that means that's, you're talking here, because it's with devotees, they're accepting a supreme, so you're talking about the third level of consciousness overwhelms the fifth. So that's why, because otherwise you can see, oh, it's moralists, they believe in God, but moralism is more prominent than God. in the fifth level, then God's more prominent, the moralist. So there's the proper balance. You know, means we talk about these things, but we generally, morality isn't normally our term. You know, we'll use dharma, we'll use etiquette, you know, Vaishnava achar, these kind of things to explain it. But just to use the word morality, then that brings up more the concept that there's social rules for social benefit, and you're not talking about social based on actual dharma. You're talking about just which you know, of the, it means, in other words, dharma is the universal laws, but which of those universal laws of dharma has been observed, and simply from the platform of sense gratification, it has been seen they're useful. You know? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say, it means your educators, you know, back, you know, had some doubts for some time, but I think back in, probably in what, 60s, maybe 70s, 80s, then kind of officially religious education was dropped as unimportant. I think they've been toying with it for a long time, that it's not important. But it would be dropped from the curriculum. And having, because they, you know, what's the point? If they have a faith, they do it at home. We're here to teach, you know, academics and that. So they dropped it. And then after so many years, then they notice that the moral fiber of the students has completely fallen apart. So they don't care for anybody, don't care for authority, don't care for the studies, don't care for the facilities, the school, anybody else. It's all about themselves. So they basically drop to the level of the first level of consciousness. And they're not even worried about developing the sophistication. So they're not, they're immature, selfish, self-centered, you know, immoralists. Right? Then it was understood as, well, okay, the same point, by having God, then, you know, the element of morality increases. So now it's worked back into the curriculum. And they try to get, you know, but before it would be more focused on whatever was the local religion. And now it's like, you know, anybody can come. If anybody can help these kids and make them more moral, they're happy to have anybody come. It's not, but it's still not that they, that the reason is because you should be God conscious, therefore, then these things will come. It's just that, you know, we're interested in moralistic behavior because you're being educated to work in a moralistic society. So therefore, if we can add some consciousness of the Supreme to that, and it'll improve the morality, then we want it. You know, and as long as it's seen that it gets the results, it'll be in the curriculum. If somebody decides it doesn't really work, they'll drop it again. Does that make sense? So that's where I'm making the distinction between the third level, where it's theistic moralists, and the fifth level, which is, you know, God, actual God consciousness. Because they may have the faith. And within this third level, then you have those that are theistic in name only. It's just by, in other words, adding the theistic element improves, it dynamically improves the morality, so therefore it's a good instrument to use, but they don't really have faith there. Right? But then you have the other, which you'll get into, is when it becomes real. No?
Mm-hmm. The genuine theist?
Genuine theist. Okay.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Let's go. Okay. When the pseudo-theist becomes strong, the genuine theist comes forward and challenges him. Oh, brother, do not think that God is simply an imaginary device. He actually exists. Consider the following reasons. Okay, so now this is the arguments of the genuine theist for the pseudo-theist.
Yes.
So these first 10 are accepted by both.
Yeah.
But the pseudo-theist stops at that.
Well, having the distinction is that, like that Pascal we were talking about, he was considered like a fideist, which means that he believed in God, but he claimed that we don't need reason to explain God. We can just have faith alone, and that logic does not interfere. And so when there are all these challenges to Christianity by the scientists and during the Enlightenment period, you know, they're saying, oh, well, the sun's not really, you know, the earth isn't really the center of the universe. There are all these challenges. And so they said, well, forget your science. We just believe in the word of God alone. They were just fideists. But these guys, the actual genuine theists, are saying, no, reason can actually prove the existence of God. We don't need to rely on faith alone. So that's another distinction.
Oh, between... Oh, so yeah. The pseudo-theist is just a matter of just have the faith because you don't want to get... Why waste valuable reasoning power on trying to understand God when the only purpose he's there is to prove morality? Use your reasoning to improve the quality of life in your moralistic society.
Yeah, that's a connection with it. But they're saying that logic can't comprehend. It's a completely separate domain.
But in one sense, they're correct. But on another sense, then logic combined with actual transcendental understanding, then you can.
Yes.
But then for those who are not connected, then logically they also have a problem because logic does have a weakness. But for most cases, a lot of it, if they're a little bit innocent through the logical elements, then you can they will appreciate.
Right.
But for somebody who is very much more philosophical or argumentative, then, you know, for every argument you come up with, they'll come up with something else. Yeah. That's why it's without faith.
Yes.
So in other words, the faith alone can work, but then faith with that understanding then works also very good.
Mm-hmm.
That works better. But logic alone will have a problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
And faith is a basis.
Yes, faith is the basis. So that way both groups will accept that.
Yeah.
It's just whether it's faith with logic or just faith alone.
Yes.
But the idea of just logic, that's thrown out by both groups.
Yes. Well, the second one, we're about to see some rational arguments for the existence of God.
No. Yeah. But I'm just saying, but still they have faith in God. And then they're being rational.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is just logic alone without faith cannot prove God's existence.
I don't know if that's their exact position. They probably have.
But I mean, that will be our position on the fifth level, but the third level they may feel because they're still basically pretty bodily conscious, so they'll have that faith that they're intelligent.
Yeah.
Yes?
It seems from point five, the first list, that the issue is it's got nothing to do with whether God exists or not. It doesn't matter whether it exists.
Yeah.
But
it's just a matter of having faith.
Just believe it. Whereas this, in the second list, that's no, it's not imaginary, he does exist.
Yeah.
This is why.
Okay. Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. One. Because the perfect law is observed in the universe, there can be no doubt that a supreme intelligence has created it and is maintaining it. The power of reasoning is the best quality in man. When that power of reasoning is operated correctly, truth is discovered. Because the perfect laws, and the point, I'm not sure if it'll come up here about that if there wasn't a supreme, I guess they're not even introducing the element of many personalities. Because that's also one of the elements of logic. There can't be many personalities, otherwise there'd be a conflict in how they'd work it out.
Yeah.
Like that. That comes in here, or that's not brought up here?
Not in this summary.
Okay. Sometimes when neglecting details, errors occurs. In operation of logic, proper concomitance is necessary. Without that, logic cannot proceed very far. In trying to come to a conclusion, two elements of the syllogism, process of reasoning, must be valid. For instance, a person may conclude that there is fire on the mountain, on seeing smoke there. First, the statement, where there is smoke, there is fire, must be valid. Secondly, what appears to be smoke must be real smoke. If these two elements of the syllogism are correct, the conclusion that there is fire on the mountain must be true. This is the process in logical inference. Beauty and perfect arrangement are observed in the workings of the universe. It is one element. Oh, I see. So you have to have these two elements.
Yes.
Okay. Beauty and perfect arrangement are observed in the workings of the universe is one element. The other element is whatever occurs by chance does not have perfect arrangement. Perfection can only be produced by a conscious entity with intelligence. From these two elements, it may be correctly concluded, quote, some great conscious entity has created this universe.
Basically, intelligent design.
intelligent design, yeah. Some people are so against intelligent design, but the funny thing is if they're actual scientists, then they would be open to the idea, because you haven't proven it wrong. You know, because if it goes by until you prove it right, you can't use it, then they can't use quantum. Quantum is based on, theorems that haven't been proven right, they just haven't been proven wrong. Your whole higher mathematical system is all on theorems, right? So therefore, they haven't proved that there isn't a God.
Yeah.
So then, as if they're actual real scientists, not just, you know, just, you know, how you say, subjective, you know, thinkers, then they would have to accept the concept that there would be, there's a possibility, until we actually get proof that there actually isn't. So that means those scientists who actually approve it aren't really scientists by mentality.
They call it the doctrine of falsifiability, is that it's impossible to actually assert the validity of something based on evidence, but you can refute it, you can prove that it's false using actual evidence. So that's the main standard for scientific truth, is whether it's falsifiable or not.
Okay.
So what they claim, their argument is that, well, you can't claim there's a God because we can't test it empirically one way or another. It's a claim that can't be verified. Like, you claim to have some spiritual experience, but we can't measure it scientifically. So it's just a completely invalid scientific premise. They don't consider it the realm of science at all. Anything that's beyond.
Yeah, but that's they're putting into the mind. But the point is just you put by mathematical calculations, the actual, by mathematically calculating chance that you would get all these varieties of species of life and all working perfectly harmoniously together, and every moment there's that's going on. Every cell of every entity is working in that same pattern. So, what is the chance for that? And the mathematical chance for that is way beyond any experiment that they would accept as valid. Yeah. Once it crosses, you know, 10 to the, you know, so many hundreds of thousands, you know, it's not a valid point anymore. So why not that you can test? But all it is that they don't want to, so they just move the test to an area that they can say, see, you can't test it. But on the other side, you can test it. Otherwise, why do they talk about chance? Can they test, have they actually taken a lightning bolt and zapped, you know, some water and gotten a living entity?
But on the topic of chance, though, their reputation is they say that actually the whole process of evolution creation is not chance. The process of natural selection is actually a mechanism which actually, through generation after generation, refines and develops and
designs. But the point is then you're saying there's intelligence there somewhere. But the thing is we don't find that the living entities themselves work it out. So what is the basis of that they worked it out? You know what I'm saying? And how can you tell that? Can you test that there was a fish there and he's tired of being harassed by the bigger fish, so he decides to make lungs and feet and walks out on the land? Can they test that? No. So therefore, then it's just as foolish a position as saying, well, you can't test your feelings in God. You can't test their stuff either. All it is just they close the door. They just are dogmatic in these areas. That's all. So they're no different than the religionists. They complain that they're dogmatic. They're just as dogmatic.
Yeah.
In fact, they're even more dogmatic.
Yeah.
First of all, you are prejudiced and we are prejudiced. So there's no discussion.
Yeah. You know, and that one scientist in Russia, I always thought that was a good one. He says, yeah, you don't believe in God, we believe in God. So at the time of death, then we'll find out who's right. You know? You know, and I always add to that, and I says, and at that point, you'll remember us. So you'll remember this conversation. In fact, they'll even remind you of the conversation.
My point is true. Using the ascending method, logically, it's not possible to prove that something does not exist. It just can't be done. You can only prove that we've never experienced it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It cannot possibly be proved that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Using the assembly method. Yeah. Actually, they have no standard to say it.
But what they say is there's a 99% chance there is no God. We can't be 100% confident because
yeah, so the point is that still, that's better than the theory.
Chance of evolution.
Yeah, the chance of evolution. So why is it 99? That's pretty high. Their chance of evolution that this goes on like this, you know, is, you know, 10 to the, you know, billionth power or something. Something absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know. Because when they talk about like one cell or one thing, and it's like this, and they reduce it down.
Yeah.
You know? Excuse me.
The interesting thing also is that Karl Darwin, in the end of his book, he also made a statement, personally, I don't believe in this world.
That's why today they're not called Darwinists anymore, they're neo-Darwinists. They acknowledge the flaws in Darwin's way of thinking, and they're going beyond.
Darwin didn't know mentioning it.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
They're still talking about different random places of genetic changes.
Yeah. I think Darwin, he was a proponent of new species being generated out of existing species. What was the difference? Yeah, I just read this book. Rethinking Darwin, that we can not believe. But he's basically explaining that, what was it? Tree of Life, you know?
Prabhupada explained that he took this idea from Venice and presented in this way, but it's not his even idea. He took this from Venice.
Yeah.
He must have studied Venice before to present his own speculation regarding this.
Yeah. Actually, I read also that Darwin wrote to one of his friends, Wallace. He mentioned that this theory is a speculation.
Yeah.
He read himself.
He said, absurd to the highest degree. He used the example of the eye. Darwin himself said, after this development, he also had his doubts about the spontaneous generation of life. That was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in the 18th century, it was an accepted fact in science. There is spontaneous generation of life.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, there is a certain amount of that there of being spontaneously generated. And then later on, sure, no, those germs that are already there, or fungus that are already there, no spontaneous generation doesn't exist.
And what's the book, the Prabhupada's? Doing Prabhupada's, being healed. With Hare Krishna, I think Hare Krishna. Giving instruction to. This is like a special name, scientific name too.
Dialectic.
Yeah, spiritualism. Yeah?
There's Beyond Illusion and Doubt. Beyond Illusion and Doubt is like the convinced.
Is it?
Yeah. They selected dialects. Dialect and spiritual is not so much.
It's other things.
If you talk to Brahmananda Prabhu in Vrindavan, he's got the the originals. He says that the one that BBT publishes is a highly abridged version. It's actually a lot more. Same with Srila Prabhupada conversations. It says that those are highly edited by some conversation that you need to fit in something. It's unknown. It's like the hidden Prabhupada
conversation.
For a price, I would
So he's selling this book?
I think it's early. Yeah, I spoke to one devotee who read that.
It seems here that all these scientists, since they don't have faith in God, they are like in the first atheistic in their mind.
Yeah, I think Maharaj is always mentioning how they're notoriously sensual, the scientists even, which are very often the most addicted to illicit activities. But then you find a lot of upstanding citizens who are very moral, they're just atheists. There's a lot of atheistic scientists.
Some moralistic, some theistic, some immoral.
Some devotees as well.
Depends on the background.
Probably some devotees also.
Although you could be, technically a real devotee who could stand and subscribe to their epistemological. Depends how much more time we have. There's also, I'd like to do something from, there's a fifth chapter where he talks about pure knowledge. And he goes over some of these other philosophies as well. And then there's a section from, it's chapter 2, which is about punya karma, about meritorious actions, pious activities. So it's quite similar for. It's just interesting because he talks about feeding animals, going on pilgrimage, building lives, but it's what is, there's the primary activities of devotional service, and he says what is foremost and what is actually the secondary activities which are beneficial for a human life. So I thought there was some overlaps there with monks and talking about. So I think that the more needs to be interesting. I think we'll finish this probably in 1 or 2 more classes. So that I'll be
full morning.
It depends on how our questions go, because this morning. How long was the actual class?
16 minutes.
16 minutes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I'll be surprised if we finish this. I remember hearing that Sadhguru, the mathematician, he and his colleagues in the mathematics department, now having doing their probability studies and so on, they knew that evolution was just ridiculous. They weren't vocal about it to the university, but within the mathematics department, especially in probability studies, they knew this is crazy.
That's not possible. Also, you have, there's one book, I saw the book, I don't remember what it was, but it was done by one professor from that discipline that Darwin's supposed to be from. That kind of, you know, what do you call it? What is this area?
Well, he would probably be probably a biochemist. Or
yeah, bio. Yeah. That biochemistry says it's not possible to prove it according to their discipline.
Yeah.
It's just not viable. And his also point was is that even if we came out with it's not viable, you know, officially, 70% of people believe in God anyway, so they're not going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
So it's just a difficult. It's just a matter of where they're putting their foot, where they're being logical and where they're being sentimental. All it is they try to move their logic where you're sentimental, but what they don't notice is that their sentimental is where your logic is.
Yeah.
You know, so they always have a sense. It has to be, because their process of reasoning is based on their particular mundane identity.
But another flaw with this level of thinking is that some claim that the mechanism of evolution is possible provided there is some intelligent force, but it's some kind of impersonal energy which is actually making the mutations which makes the changes in species possible.
Yeah.
So they don't have any faith in Bhagavan, in the actual person.
No, but
they have faith in some intelligence.
Yeah.
So that's why it's inferior.
But then Brahman, but they have to have Paramatma. You have to at least come to that level.
Okay. Yeah.
Because the point is why would you want to evolve something?
Yeah.
You know? Why do you need to evolve something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not that it's just a matter of what's happening at the time, because otherwise the same thing keeps going on and on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that one there's that one BTG article. It may have been like Jutta Karma or something. It has a picture of this ancient fish. It says something like, I can't remember this, 3 million BC or, then it has next door with the same fish, you know, exactly the same, you know, 300,000 BC, then 10,000 BC, and then today. And it hasn't changed in 3 million years. So why is it ever this evolution, or, you know, is always going on and all this kind of thing? Everything has to improve. The point is it works. Why do you need to fix it? You know what I'm saying? The fish are, you know, the point is if you understand elevation, evolution was important, if why are there, I mean, why does there need to be land animals on the land or in the air if there's still fish? If being a fish was totally unviable, then everything would be out on the land. You know? Yeah, but why is it there's more living entities in the ocean than there is on the land? I think they say, this ocean worms that live in the mud under the ocean, by volume and weight, is more than all the other living entities on the planet put together. You know? And who even hears about them? You don't even hear about them. You know, so I mean, it seems to be a quite viable species of life. Why did it need to, you know, grow legs and wings and, you know, fingers around a computer or something like that? You know, just, you know, and now this is the shocking fact. I mean, I don't want to disturb anyone. I don't want to create any nightmares here. But now all those worms are living there, their whole life going on, and they're doing it without Facebook. How is it possible? I mean, even just for that, you'd think that they develop at least fingers, right? You know? You know, get yourself one of those, you know, military waterproof computers, and then, hey, they're good to go.
The face.
Yeah, so you need a face also. Yeah. But still, now these arguments that are given here, this is from a genuine theist.
Yes.
So these are bona fide arguments.
This isn't the fifth level, this is still the third level.
Okay, yeah. But it's what level you can use at that point. So most generally speaking, these ones can be used very nicely.
Yeah, there was one like, for example, I think it's St. Thomas Aquinas, he has his five reasons, five ways, and they're like basically the intelligent design argument, the argument of first cause. And someone presented this to Srila Prabhupada, and he says, yes, these are bona fide arguments to prove God, but ultimately we don't rely on these kind of rational arguments. We have Shastra.
Yeah. Means, we'll use them as examples, yeah. But it's not the yeah. basis of the real point.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare
Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki.
Jai. Jai
Nitai Gaurav.
Hare Hare.